This podcast doesn't do commercials for a number of reasons that you'll hear me discuss if you listen long enough. But if you want to support this work, feel free to click on the link at the bottom of most podcatchers that says support the show. Half of everything donated goes to addicted people, people struggling with homelessness, and people who are struggling to get out of prison and back on their feet. Enjoy the show. Oh, hey, Pastor. Nice to meet you. I was just wondering if you would mind if a group of me and my friends who all use drugs and who are not going to try to quit using drugs, if we got together once or twice a week and used a room in your church to talk about our use, to support one another in using, to share tricks about how to use drugs safely. By the way, it's not going to be religious at all. In fact, most of us will probably be atheist. How's your church feel about that? Welcome, I'm Ben Boyce, this is the Dr. Junkie Show, and today's episode is, well, it's about a lot, and I know that's been happening a lot, but bear with me, because as opposed to making a loose script, like I sometimes do on these thicker episodes, or trying to actually write everything down in an outline, I think I'm going to spitball this with literally just a few words to remember each point in front of me, and try to make sense of it for you as I go. And we're going to pick up some of the threads I've been laying out for the last few years, and then particularly for the last few months. But I want to start with a thought experiment. Imagine you wake up this morning and you're itchy. You run in the bathroom and you look in the mirror and you realize you got these little bumps all over you. So you make an appointment with your doctor, you go in there and you say, "Man, I got this awful rash going on, doc. What can I do?" The doctor says, "Don't worry. I've seen this 1,000 times. There's one treatment for it, and here's what you gotta do." And the doctor outlines a number of things that they need you to conform to for a certain amount of time if you want to treat the disease. You're not real happy about some of them, like they want you to eat healthier, or you're supposed to exercise a certain amount every day, or maybe you gotta get up in the middle of the night and smear some cream on your rash. I don't know, but you do it anyway. Now let's say you go through the treatment, say 30 days. And at the end of the treatment, you go home and you look in the mirror and you realize, "Oh crap, I have the rash everywhere." So imagine the doctor at this point says, "That's your fault. It doesn't matter that you conform to the prescribed treatment. It's clearly your fault if it's recurring. You've got to try harder next time." And then, just to add insult to injury, let's say the doctor prescribes the exact same treatment again. Just do it again. Maybe it'll work this time. You can imagine you would be not only disheartened, but you might start to wonder if your doctor was actually looking at your condition as a disease at all. So today I'm going to talk about 12-step treatment programs. Shout out to Bonnie, who sent me an email a few weeks ago, reminding me that even though I've talked about this a few times, there's still a lot to be said, especially considering some of the stuff I've been talking about lately. So a few reminders so I don't have to stick too long on some of the topics I've talked about before. If you haven't heard me talk about 12-step programs, check out episode 119, where I talk about Bill Wilson's history and how he designed the program. And then if you want to go back further and check the vault of episodes that, even when I listen to them, they kind of sound creepy. I feel like I was trying too hard. Maybe I still do. Anyway, episode 36, The Problem with 12-Step Programs. I'm going to try to avoid rehashing all of those episodes today and add to them. And if you want to learn more about neoliberalism, the cult of pharmacology, Herbert Marcuse, or Marcuse, or Marcuse, as I called him last episode, I've actually heard it pronounced all three ways, you can check out episode 109, where I talked to Toby Seddon. But today, we have different work to focus on. And to do that work, let's remind ourselves of a few of the terms that I've mentioned before on this podcast. A cult of pharmacology, the cult part being the most important. Think about how a cult works. There's someone or something that's the head of the cult, and they're held to a standard that nobody else would ever be held to. They can make incredible claims that sometimes don't track with reality, and people will claim to believe them. When those claims don't turn out to be true, instead of holding them accountable, people will often rapidly forget they were wrong and then believe them the next time they make a huge claim. That's the stuff of a cult. Now think about the United States in reference to pharmaceutical industries and in reference to the law. U.S. citizens see both of these things the same way we would see cult leaders. I mean, think about it. The law, maybe the easiest realm to spot this mentality, tells us things about drugs that over and over we realize later on they were wrong about. Marijuana is a gateway drug. MDMA will put holes in your brain. If you use drugs at all, you'll become hopelessly addicted. And later on, we realize it's all horseshit. But we still are forced to follow their rules because they will literally come to our houses and steal our freedom. They'll lock us up. Now with pharma, it's harder to spot because it's more insidious. They're not going to come to your house and lock you up. They're just going to sell you a product that doesn't work for the rest of your life if they can. And that product will be based on whatever the last big promise that actually failed on. Some of the original pharma products were things like morphine and opium. And when they realized, oh crap, people are addicted to these things, they came up with a new drug called heroin, which was described as curing morphine addiction. And we've gone through various stages since then. For a long time, barbiturates were on the market, promised as some magic cure to anxiety and depression. But then those were replaced when they were said to be too dangerous by benzodiazepines, which were then later said to be too dangerous to mass prescribe. So they were replaced with serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors. But then when those were found to not work later, they were replaced with what were called SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And now we're at the end of that chapter of Big Pharma in the United States, as consumers have started to realize that those drugs aren't all they were cracked up to be. So it looks like the next drug that's on the verge of a big breakthrough are glutamate drugs, like ketamine. If you want to hear more about that, you can check out episode 95, Ketamine. The point is, this isn't new. It's a cult mentality. We're always promised something that's hard to believe, and then it turns out to not be true after we've bought it, so we just buy the next big thing anyway, even though it's also not true. Now, we also live in a neoliberal society, as you've probably grown tired of hearing me repeat if you've been listening for the last few months. Basically, the government is oriented towards protecting big business. This started in the Reagan era, where there was this reorientation in thinking that said, instead of giving tax cuts to lower income people so that they have more money, we could give tax cuts to billionaires and industry owners so that they have more money, and then, of course, like all humans, they'll give that money to their employees. They'll hire more people. They'll buy a million pairs of socks for some reason. Now, it's been 40 years, and if you can't tell from my tone, it didn't quite turn out that way. But that's the mentality we have now. And because of that mentality, industry rules the day. We are all supposed to be programmed up to feel like we're supposed to find an industry, an institution that we can support and maybe ingrain ourselves in. I mean, think about what you do for a living. No matter what it is, you probably support an institution that has found its way into the mainstream and therefore garnered the respect of at least some portion of the public. Even if you work as a private contractor, or even if, like I used to do during my PhD years when I was trying to get my degree, I would fly out to Vegas, I would get on Craigslist and buy a bunch of four-wheelers from strangers, I'd stuff them all in the back of a U-Haul truck, and I'd drive it back to Denver and sell them because there was a profit margin if I could make that 12-hour trip one or two times a month. That was the only way I paid the rent. And I might say on first sight, I wasn't supporting industry. I was a private contractor. But I was still supporting industry. I was offering an alternative to somebody who might otherwise go to the dealership up the road, and to offer them that alternative, I had to buy the same brand so I could appeal to that same sense of institutional trust. I had to make sure I could say the same things that the dealership could say to set their heart at ease. The only reason to come to me was money, itself an institution that interacts with all other ones, and that by coming to me, they could actually gain some institutional power. They could have the four-wheeler they wanted to buy, and they could also still keep some of that money for themselves to use for something else. And don't forget, this whole time, I was interacting with institutions at every level. I was booking tickets on a website. I was flying on a jetliner. I was renting the trucks from U-Haul. I was stopping at gas stations and fast food places and hotel chains the whole way home. I was supporting institutional power, and that's the only reason that job was a thing at all. So we've got two quick definitions, okay, maybe not so quick, but I tried, of both neoliberal culture and of the cult of pharmacology. Now keep in mind with both of these things acting at once, as it does in our culture, that we all feel like if we could just get away, if we could just break the patterns and go to, I don't know, a nice beach somewhere in the Caribbean, if I could just reset for a couple weeks and get out of my own head, man, I think things would be different. I could make those changes I've been putting off. That's just a normal condition we stay in. I've described it as the hole in our souls in the last few episodes. It's this mentality we have where we're always promised the next big thing that can fix anything if we just have enough money, and the promises never pay off. Meanwhile, we're supposed to trade our individual identities for corporate identities, institutional identities, things that don't feed our spirits the way they once did. It's no wonder we're in such a condition. So keep that mentality in mind that I just want to get away and do something and I think things would be better, and I think we'll have an easier time making sense of why 12-step programs have had the success they've had. We always feel like when a problem arises, when a feeling shows up, when a need is apparent, that if we just do something, anything, it's better than doing nothing. And when it comes to addictions, the biggest problems that most of us will ever face in our lives, a terrifying situation that often arises out of the blue for families, they want to do something, and the only show in town is 12-step programs. There's very few alternatives. So let's dive into whether or not they at least work, and what it means to say that a 12-step program works. The first thing to note is that when you go on the websites of places like the Betty Ford Clinic or other big-name clinics that use a 12-step model, you're not going to find any outside research to verify their effectiveness. You will find research, but if you dig deep, you'll realize that that research is almost always from an institution that is funded directly by the rehab. If you go to the Betty Ford Clinic, for instance, if you just Google how effective is the Betty Ford Clinic, you'll find something called the Butler Research Center that has tons of data posts basically saying that they're about 50% effective depending on what time frame you look at and how you measure effectiveness. But when I tried to find the study that this statistic was pulled from, there's no links. When I tried to go to the Butler Center for Research's website, it's actually hyperlinked in the Betty Ford article, I wound up linking back and forth between the Betty Ford Clinic and a Betty Ford Clinic Butler Center article that described the findings from research without a direct link to the research article. So I tried to call the number they have listed. It was 651-213-4200. My phone said it wasn't a real number, but I did send an email to an address they had listed and asked for the actual articles, and I will let you know if I actually hear something back. But I couldn't find anything except summaries that were never linked to the actual research where they claim they actually got that data. But to really get to the bottom of why people disagree so much about how effective the program is, we've got to talk about what research is. A double-blind controlled study would mean the following. Double-blind means the doctors don't know which person in the group is getting one treatment versus the other, and the patients don't know whether they're getting one treatment or the other. That wouldn't work for reasons I'll explain in a minute. And a control study means a study with a control group, a group that gets the opposite treatment or a different form of treatment that qualifies as what other people might get in the real world. You want to make sure the thing that you're doing and then testing to see whether or not it provides the results you're looking for, you want to make sure that's the reason those results are showing up so you don't mischaracterize the effectiveness of the program or the drug. And of course, the third thing we want in a good study is randomization. You want to literally make sure that the people that go to one treatment or get one pill are pulled randomly from a public that is almost the same as much as you can control for as the ones that get the other treatment. Now, having laid out this basic design, think about how incredibly awful and difficult it would be to ever do anything similar to that in a study about addiction. Don't forget that research is expensive. So to begin with, to do this the right way, we need to find an institution, a university, a pharmaceutical company, a law enforcement division, a nonprofit, somebody with deep pockets to pay for it. And we're going to pitch it like this. I want to find a group of very similar people who have just been diagnosed with addiction for the first time. I want to make sure none of them have a history with 12-step programs or any other treatments. I want to break them into, let's say, two groups to keep it simple. I want to send half of these fellas to a 12-step program, and I want to tell the other half to beat it. They get nothing. And I want to do it randomly. I want to make sure that there's nothing I do that says, well, if you're religious, I'll send you to the 12-step program more than likely, but if you're not, hit the streets. No, I want to take equal amounts of people who are religious and not, equal amounts of people of different races, equal amounts of people of different backgrounds. I want to randomize this thing so I get good study results. And we're already in the water. Because to tell half of a group of young people who have just been diagnosed with addiction to hit the streets, good luck, do what you want, and we'll talk to you in a year, well, that's terrible. But I want to stick here for a minute because there is a statistic about what would happen if we did that. There's something called spontaneous remission. And when it comes to alcohol, or all drugs for that matter, something between 4 to 8% of people, depending on the study you look at, that are addicted to any substance using the standards of the DSM, where you have a negative quality of life, they just quit using over the course of any year when they're not receiving any sort of treatment whatsoever. That's just part of being a human. We age out, we find a new partner, we encounter something that changes how we feel, or we just get tired of a substance because maybe it's not working as well as it once did. So the number we've got to compete with, and this is a statistic I'm pulling actually from a meta-analysis by Zimberg. I can link it on the episode website if you want to look it up. We should keep that in line as a baseline, as the closest thing we could get to a control group for a group of addicted people who never got any treatment at all. They never sought it out, at least not during the time when they stopped using drugs. Now, to do a controlled study on a 12-step program, say AA, you would need to somehow do magic. You would have to go into the program and say, everybody that's visited for the last year, whether they've come back once or not, whether they're still here or not, whether you have their phone number or not, whether they were here for 5 minutes or for the whole year, can we get their information and can we add them all to a group and study whether or not the program worked for them? I mean, if we're talking about success rates, we should at least start with a study that says, everybody that's so desperate to stop using drugs that they walked in the door of a 12-step program, how many of them were effective at quitting? How many of them stopped drinking if that's what they were there to do? We're already in trouble because when researchers walk into a 12-step meeting, a lot of people didn't come back over the last year, and you can't study those people. So it's estimated that about 14 to 31% of people who try a 12-step program stick with it for a year. That means more than 2 out of 3 leave the program every year. And we've got to keep that in mind anytime we're going to look at study results that purport to say AA is incredibly successful, because the only people that are interviewed in these study results, remember, it is AA, anonymous, are people who have been in the program for a year. And then they ask them, was it effective for you? So if you're looking at those numbers, on average, something like 21 to 22% of people that work in AA program for an entire year will be sober for an entire year. They will still have maintained no drinking. I have a problem with this specific definition of success. A lot of addicted people resent the idea of accumulating what they call clean time or finding successful strategies to navigate addiction, but then one day you fail. One day you have one beer and all of that clean time is gone and you've got to start from scratch. Now, what a lot of studies have started to use is something called percentage of days sober. And some studies have even started to look at how intense the drinking is when people decide to drink. But these are relatively new and they actually present this problem for research as it's coming of age and catching up to itself, whereby researchers use different terms and different criteria in different studies. So it's really hard to do an analysis on all of the analyses that have been done, a meta-analysis. One has been done, and I'll get to that in just a second, but I want to make sure I finish up unpacking what the data that is available about 12-step programs actually tells us. So 100 people walk into a 12-step program. On average, 14 to 31 of them will be there in 1 year. Of those 14 to 31 people, 1 in 5 of them will have stayed sober for a whole year. 5 to 8%. That's not a success rate that we should just accept and stop working on the problem, stop looking for other solutions. Now, I mentioned there is a new meta-analysis. It's a few years old now. It was released by the Cochrane Institute, and it's something like 135 pages. I'll also link that in the episode description if you want to torture yourself like I did and actually read it. But what it says is that if you can wade through the different terms that are used and the different criteria for abstinence and success in these programs and the different ways that researchers approached groups that often caused problems in the data being verifiable, if you can get through all of that and you're a good researcher, you'll find that 12-step programs are about as effective as other programs that are on offer, including cognitive behavioral therapy, which is what I usually suggest to anyone that's struggling with addiction. Because I don't think addictions are really a thing so much as just something that shows up in our lives as a compulsion, as a solution. I've called them a learning disorder in the past because drugs fucking work. That's why we use them. And when we use them and they work, haha, we learn to use them the next time we have the same problem, when we feel a way we don't like feeling. Of course, when those drugs stop working, or when they don't work as well as they used to, and they also come with massive problems, our issue is we don't immediately learn to stop using that solution, even though it's not solving the problem we had. We keep using it anyway. It's a learning disorder. It's a compulsive disorder. We find something that makes us feel a little bit better about a problem we can't solve, and we keep using it because it's all we've got. So why 12-step programs? Well, that's a hard story that, like I said, you might get a better image of where these programs came from and why they stuck in episode 119. But the reason they're still here right now is because they align with our neoliberal culture. Number one, they're free. You don't have to hire professionals and you don't have to rent out a space because we've incorporated these things into community centers and into, number two, churches. And the reason that churches don't generally have an issue with 12-step programs meeting in their basements or their foyers is because 12-step programs are Christian programs. I've talked about this a lot before. Here's a few quotes from Bill Wilson over the years, AA's creator, the original 12-step. In the big book he wrote, "To some people we need not, and probably should not, emphasize the spiritual features on our first approach. We might prejudice them. At the moment, we are trying to put our lives in order, but this is not an end in itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God." This is a religious organization. 20 years after his conversion, Bill Wilson was quoted in the book The Sober Truth as saying he wanted every alcoholic to be able to say, as he could, that their belief in God was no longer a question of faith, but the certainty of knowledge gained through evidence. It's a Christian organization. Bill Wilson's grandpa claimed, before Bill Wilson was born, to have been taken up to heaven while on top of a mountain by himself and conversed with God, after which he sort of changed his life and became a better person. And Bill Wilson claimed to have had a very similar experience where he talked to God and was told, "You have to turn your life over to God and use your relationship with God to stop drinking." At one point, Wilson wrote, quote, "The early AA got its ideas of self-examination, acknowledgement of character defects, restitution for harm done, and working with others straight from the Oxford group and directly from Sam Shoemaker, their former leader in America, and from nowhere else." If you don't know what the Oxford group is, it's a religious organization that has six tenets that are eerily similar to the 12 steps of AA. And by the way, if you haven't read the 12 steps of AA, I'll spare you reading through them all here, but take a minute to Google them and you'll realize it is a roadmap for religiosity. It basically is 12 steps that say, admit you're powerless and sinful, find a higher power or God who you can pour your sins upon and ask for forgiveness, give all your sins to him and repent, both to him and to the world. And then finally, step 12, proselytize. Go out into the world and take the message to others. Yeah, it's a religion. And because it's a religion, it feels like it works for a lot of people because they show up there and they find a group of like-minded people who seem very interested in both what's going on in the group and in moral and ethical concerns that they both agree on, much larger than themselves. And they find what addicted people really need, that social connection that neoliberalism strips out. If addiction is helplessness to fix a feeling that somebody has, And relatedly, looking for a solution, and when we can't find one, we use something else that doesn't actually solve the problem, but becomes a habit because it at least makes us feel a little bit better. If that's what addiction is, and it is, then of course a God or a higher power works for some when we have a framework permeating our culture that says when you've made a mistake, repent to a higher power, turn it over to them, get your butt in church on Sunday, and you're redeemed. You don't have to do the work. You don't have to focus on yourself. You don't have to look at your situation and say, is something about how I'm living my life or my living situation causing issues that are making these compulsive urges worse? Am I self-medicating something? Forget all that. Why look at the cultural issues, the neoliberal issues our society is forcing on you that are making you miserable and causing you to use so much of this drug? Why look at those things when you can just look to the drug and look to your higher power? That's why these programs work. Your higher power is Big Daddy. He can literally fix anything. No wonder that makes you feel better, whether it's real or not. It's worth pointing out here, though, as what I call a recovering Christian, somebody who gave up evangelical Christianity when I stopped believing it about 10, 15 years ago now, and has since come to a lot of realizations about how warped my thinking was when I was in that circle. The experience of losing your belief in a higher power can be brutal, especially when you have a social network that will not stick around you if you lose that belief and admit it. So there's a danger here. When people really work the program and feel as if their higher power, God, has helped them get through something, but then they slip and the higher power isn't working anymore, well, talk about devastating. You had access to the creator of the universe who was giving you personal favors, and now you've lost it. Or maybe you never had it at all. Ouch. I can relate. And that's one of the dangers of forcing these programs on people as a one-size-fits-all, take it or leave it, this is what you're supposed to do if you're trying to get better, and if you don't do it, you're a bad person, system like we have. Of course, if you use these programs and they work for you, keep using them. As I always say, my problem isn't with a program that works for some people. My problem is with it being the only show in town and with a system that's set up to make sure it stays that way. The rehab industries can thrive off it because they don't have to go out of their way to hire a bunch of psychotherapists who make big salaries because they went to school to learn their shit. The best person to run a 12-step meeting is a recovering addicted person who probably doesn't have a lot of official training and therefore isn't going to be as expensive to hire. Neoliberalism dumbs down and cheapens everything. It's about mass production and labeling a product with all sorts of promises that are never going to come true, but people fucking believe them anyway. There's a lot packed in there, and I hope without having some thicker notes before I started that didn't get off track, so I'm hoping I didn't lose y'all along the way. The short story is that people that don't do anything for their addictions stop using at a rate of 4-8% every year. People that bust their ass and go to a meeting every day, even if they don't like it. People who white-knuckle their way through it and get through rehab, they can expect to not be drinking at a rate of something like 5-8% a year. And of course, all of it's self-reported, and if you're a sponsor or you've been helping a lot of people in your local meeting for a while, well, you can understand a lot of reasons that might pop into somebody's head, to not mention the few relapses they had last month. Or the time they smoked crack for a week around Christmas. People rely on their story, and they rely on that belief in a higher power. So it's possible that even the numbers we have, which are almost always based on self-reporting, that they're also exaggerated. So 4-8% if you do nothing, something like 12% max if you go to a 12-step meeting for a whole year. And we don't have a lot of good statistics on what programs that are psychotherapeutic but focused on treating people with substance abuse issues specifically, how successful they are, aside from the fact that they appear to be very similar to these 12-step programs that often cost $100,000 a pop. And of course, don't forget the story I started with. If you really do knuckle down and you go to that meeting every day and you get through that year of AA and you're one of the majority of people who won't have succeeded according to their standards, you won't be 100% drug or alcohol free, that's going to be blamed on you. Because the current gold standard of treatment and what we claim to think about as a disease, addiction not only has incredibly low rates of success, but when people don't succeed, it's never the program's fault, despite very little data that shows these programs were actually built on anything like real evidence to begin with. They were built on God, the prevailing system of the era when Bill Wilson created these programs in the mid-1900s. They're still built on God today. Hopefully that gets a little more at what Bonnie was mentioning and what was missing from some of these previous episodes. And if not, send me some emails and I'll try to do a better job next time. Until then, love yourselves and the addicted people in your life. I'm Ben Boyce.